chance to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their community. How are you this week? It's great to have you here. It really is. I hope you're doing okay. Hope you're staying safe and healthy. It's fascinating how that's become the normal greeting now. Hope you're safe. Hope you're healthy. But it's true. I hope you are. Today on the show, I talked to Stephanie Swan, who is a major part of the Modernist Cuisine team that's put out books like the Modernist Bread Book a few years ago, and today is launching a new set of books all about pizza called Modernist Pizza. And yeah, she's on the show. We're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about pizza. We're going to talk about pizza places and variations and history and travel and all of that stuff coming up in a few minutes. So stay tuned. It's exciting. It's a good one. Before then, though, I just want to acknowledge that this is the 150th episode of the Rise Up Podcast. How cool is that? It seems pretty cool to me. I have to say, when I hit 100 shows, I thought, oh my gosh, that's pretty amazing. Where do we go from here? And then 150 just boom, just happened. I don't know, like when it's a weekly show and you do a show every week and it's a year since your 100th, you should be hitting a 150, shouldn't you? But I don't know. It still seems cool to me. I never thought I would do 150 podcast episodes. And these days, I can't imagine not doing these podcast episodes for you. I really enjoy it. I still struggle sending out invitations. It's incredible. You know, I should probably just recruit a producer or assistant or someone that is in charge of lining up the conversations, because 150 in, no matter who I've talked to, from the people I hold in my mind as the biggest and most important bakers and teachers in our profession, to someone who is just starting out and starting, you know, baking out of their house and dreaming of opening up a retail shop one day, or dreaming of, you know, growing into a farmer's market, what have you, no matter who it is, I am nervous as heck about sending out those emails inviting folks to come onto the show. And still am. It's no different than the very first episode. And so, yeah, so I need some sort of help with that. That would make these shows go a lot easier, I have to say. So if you're interested in helping out by being the person to track down people to talk to and set that up, that would, boy, oh boy, that would sure help. You know, I usually talk about how to support the show. That's the one. That's the one for me. But it's been quite a journey, these 150 episodes. It's been so much fun getting to meet people. Some of the earlier episodes, you know, I've had a chance to circle back and talk to folks for a second time or get an update. Sometimes we do it on the mic. Sometimes we just, I'll just share the update on the show. That's been fun. It's been really, really special to realize the breadth of our profession. And I guess that was a pun, but it's a very broad profession. There are so many different ways to feed the people in your community. And that's always been a joy of discovering new ways and new models and new ways of thinking of things. I just had a chat with a woman yesterday that's going to be on a future show. And just the way she saw how she did her production planning just kind of blew my mind. It was like, oh yeah, boy, does that ever work? Good for you. You know, so we'll talk about that next week. But it's been fun, and it's been fun to uncover, to discover, to learn about, to spend time talking about the personal side of this life that we all have as bakers. You know, it's been It's fun to geek out on sourdough starters or production techniques or the nuts and bolts of doing what we do. What I call like the craft of baking. That's a pile of fun. And there's an endless amount of things to learn to get good at our craft and then to master it, which is something beyond where I'm at for sure. And it's a whole other thing to dig into the nuts and bolts of the business aspect of owning and running a bakery, no matter what the size, from, you know, the smallest cottage operation to the largest multi-location, you know, we're dominating the Eastern Seaboard kind of bake shop. And still, I get most of my kicks in understanding the person behind the bakery and getting to know them a little bit and getting to understand what makes them happy and what makes them excited and what brings them joy and what scares them and what they're wrestling with right now. And that's a lot of fun. It's been a little interesting meeting someone for the very first time and trying to get to that point. And I don't always get there. Some, maybe, you know, to be fair, maybe I rarely get there, but it's where I like to go. And so, that's what I'm striving for. And that's what keeps giving me the juice to keep doing this week after week, because you're always trying to make a connection with somebody, just like you do with your baked goods and your staff and your branding and your design. And you're trying to impart a feeling and a good positive feeling onto the people around you. And so, way to go. I'm glad I get to be part of this through this show. Okay, so Stephanie Swan, when the show goes out on the 6th of October, it'll be a day after the launch of Modernist Pizza, which is another series of books from the Modernist cuisine team in Washington State in the U.S., These are the folks that 5 years ago came out with Modernist Bread, which is the largest, most complete sort of state of the art of the history and craft and science of bread baking that had been published to that point, maybe might ever be published. And they did the same thing with pizza. And you'll hear me in talking with Stephanie that, you know, I thought that they were going to add like a volume onto the Modernist Bread collection. And nope, they went whole hog. They did like 4 volumes and, you know, 1,700 pages and 3,000 photographs and went the whole 9 yards on pizza, which is pretty cool. And Stephanie is the publisher and the editorial director of this book and the Modernist Bread book. So, you know, she led the whole editorial team in writing and researching and developing the set of books. And it was a lot of fun talking with her. She's also, you know, pretty seriously into the bread and the baking world. You know, she is a member of a lot of different groups in her local state and larger across North America about women in cooking, women in hospitality, you know, bakers against racism, and on and on and on. So she's deeply into this world and also comes from this creative publishing background. So it's a lot of fun talking to her about all of those things. I should point out that this was like the low point of the year in terms of Zoom reliability. And we had a couple of glitches on the call. At one point, I got kicked out of Zoom altogether. So there is a little bit of a gap, and we regrouped and continued talking. So my apologies for that up front. But here we go. I have more to say on this after our talk, but let's get into it with Stephanie Swan, the publisher and editorial director of Modernist Cuisine, talking about pizza. Let's go. Yeah. Yeah. So are you in Washington?
I am. Our office is based in Bellevue, and I'm in my home kitchen in Ballard, which is...
Oh, I know where Ballard is. Yeah. Yeah, lovely. Yeah, I've been to Seattle a couple of times, and...
Where are you at?
I'm in Victoria, British Columbia, so just...
I love Victoria.
I can maybe see you from my apartment, I'm not sure.
And I can't wait till I can go back to Victoria again.
Yeah, we've been out here 2 years now, just about 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And they're quite liking it.
Yeah, we used to go up to tour. There's a couple of good breweries there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a great city. I love the... I'm a huge gardener. So I would always come up for the garden tour.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's been a bit of an interesting change for me here with, 4 real seasons, even though like winter, okay, it's not really winter, but fine, but it's just the, you know, how early you can plant things, how late can they grow? You know, it's been a pile of fun for sure.
I know. Yeah. I was in New York before coming to Seattle. So I've been here almost 10 years, and I was in New York for about 12-ish years. And it was so great to have longer planting seasons. And I have a greenhouse.
Oh, yeah.
So I invested in a greenhouse when we moved here, and I love it because it's also great here because I can start things in, you know, February.
Yeah, totally.
Because especially if we have a mild winter and go through till, you know, I'm actually just starting some seeds right now to put in the ground for the fall, which in New Jersey, in New York, there's no way I could do that.
Totally. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, and my son gave me some garlic that he had picked and was drying and stuff and half to plant and half to eat. And so I'm going to try garlic. We're just in an apartment, so I've just got a couple grow beds on the balcony, but I'm going to try it.
Garlic's so easy.
Yeah. Yeah. We're growing a ton of, it's been a great tomato and pepper year for me. So that's nice. Yeah.
Same with us. So we've had that nice warm weather. We didn't have much tomatoes and peppers weren't great last year, but this year they're doing really well. I have my garlic necks in my greenhouse right now drying. So yeah.
Very cool. So I was reading your, I'll ask you first.
Sure.
I saw in your bio that you're originally from the Dakotas.
So yeah. So my dad is from South Dakota. My dad's family. So my dad's mother and father both came here from Denmark, and they landed in South Dakota, which was a very big Scandinavian population.
Yes.
Norwegian, yeah. Danish, amazing bakers. My grandmother, I inherited all of her recipe cards, and I went through all of them. And it was really funny because I was going to make a book out of them, but I ended up just keeping them. I still haven't made the book, but eventually I will. But I started putting them in piles of different types of foods. And slowly and surely, I noticed that the stack for the dessert/bake things were literally like this tall. Everything else. I mean, also she's a product of the Depression. So the meats were like this tall, but I feel like that's true Scandinavian culture, is like cakes, you know, desserts, rolls, like all of that. So my grandmother was actually, both my grandmothers were amazing bakers. But my grandmother swung on in South Dakota. Literally, we would go to visit every year. And we would walk in and the whole house smelled like cookies.
Right.
You know, it permeated cookies. Like, and she was one of those grandmothers that you went and that she would have canisters of, you know, 5-6 different kinds of cookies. She would make my father's favorite pies, plural. You know, we would only be there for like a week or maybe, but like it was just baked good after baked good. Long answer, yes, I am from, my dad's from South Dakota.
Oh, cool.
My family's still there. All of my dad's family pretty much is there. So I've got cousins and uncles and you name it. In fact, we were there for a wedding in May.
Oh, wow.
One of my cousin's daughters, she got married. So
nice.
We went to see the family, and it was so much fun. I love South Dakota. Are you from South Dakota or family?
Well, I'm from Saskatchewan. Right, so just
north of us.
Yeah. Yeah. So, That's why I asked, because I said, oh, okay, we probably have a bit in common from an experience side a little bit. Yeah. So I grew up in Regina, Saskatchewan. So say 4 hours from Minot, North Dakota.
Right.
I've only been to South twice. When as a kid, we went to the Black Hills and Mount Rushmore and all of that. And then had a very interesting cycling expedition with the family and the cycling club at, what is it, Teddy Roosevelt Park?
Oh, so I was just there when we were at the wedding. It's right above Deadwood.
Yeah. And so we went there once.
A beautiful view.
It's like growing up on the prairies, because you go down, right? Like if you want to see the cool stuff, you know, it's not mountains, it's valleys, and you go down and then it's spectacular. And yeah, well, it's stunning country out there.
Yeah. I'm very fortunate that I grew up in California, but we were in South Dakota for my dad's family. Pretty much every summer we went and spent extended periods of time there. So I'm really fortunate that I spent so much time and still do, you know, it's really beautiful country there. It's just an interesting place.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and
great bakers there.
Yeah. You know, I've met several from North Dakota. The South is still kind of a mystery to me, but I'm working my way inland. That's, you know, that's part of the fun of the podcast, is that, you know, I get to talk to people from places that I only kind of know on a map a little bit, right? Because I could spend a lifetime in San Francisco and New York talking to people or whatever, but, you know, it's okay. Learning the difference between Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Pennsylvania, I find kind of cool.
Oh yeah, it's totally different. Same with North and South Dakota. So different. My grandparents both came as farmers. And so my grandfather's family, we still have people that own farms in North Dakota, wheat farmers, mostly commodity, large family farms. So, and then my aunt has a ranch. And so they've had a variety of cattle, and all my cousins are in the rodeo or were in the rodeo now that they're older. Wow, now their kids are all in the rodeo. My youngest cousin, well, I guess he's the second cousin. He's my cousin's son. He is, he's Braden's six now. He's in the rodeo. So it's just really amazing to watch and see everyone continue on with a lot of the traditions.
Yeah, those ranch folks are crazy. Yeah, like my grandparents were grain farmers, right? And so, but you get a little further south and you get into the ranch land and that, and then the rodeo guys start showing up, and it's wild times.
Oh yeah, I know there's a lot of rodeo in Saskatchewan.
Kind
of that middle belt, lots of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and congratulations on this book. I have to say,
thank you. I always laugh when people are like, "What do you call it a book? Like, do you call it like what do you call it?" Because
you got me at the stainless steel case that it comes in. It was like,
I know. Aren't those? I'm really excited about the new one for pizza, which is the red, beautiful glossy red. I call it Ferrari red. I probably can't. I can technically say it, but I couldn't write it.
That's right.
Because then I would get into trouble, paying licensing fees. But the stainless steel case for bread was something that I was really excited about, trying to make something that was both luxurious, you know, looking very appeasing, but also could be put in your kitchen without, you know, having a problem of decay or whatever. But then also the sturdiness, because each of our books weighs about 10 pounds. Mm-hmm. And so when you put 5 for bread and now 3 for pizza, you know, you're talking 30 to 50 pounds inside a case.
We are experiencing technical difficulties. Please stand by.
Do you want me to talk about the case?
Yeah. So, well, I wanted to say congratulations for the book. And I'll say right up front, when I heard that Modernist Pizza was coming out, because I've seen the Modernist Bread books and I had it in my head, oh, they've added an extra volume, you know, about pizza. And it's like, no, this is the full treatment. Like What, it's four volumes, isn't it?
So it's right. It's three volumes plus our handy dandy kitchen manual.
Right.
So 1700 plus pages just on pizza.
In a stainless steel case this time, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's in a beautiful red glossy stainless steel case that houses the three volumes. We also created this thing called the wedge. So we have like these two wedges on each side. So it makes it easier for you to pull the books in and out. And then the recipe manual comes on the side. But it's funny that you mentioned, it's actually the reverse. While we were working on bread, it was a topic when we started looking at the world of flatbreads. We were trying to think, okay, you know, pizza would go into the chapter about flatbreads because it's a base with toppings is pizza. And when we started looking at the research for bread, a lot of really interesting things kept coming up about pizza. And so at that time, while we were working the 5 years we worked on bread, we set aside and said, you know what, pizza to us seems like a really, like the next project, like a really great project to fit to work on individually rather than trying to incorporate it into bread. So in the bread book, in Modernist Bread, we do have a couple of pizza recipes just so that someone would say, you know, I didn't want to get the customer service email saying, you talk about flatbread, but where's pizza?
Right.
So it was done intentionally just to give you like a little tasting of pizza, but not the full, the full deal. So pizza, 1700 pages. It's very similar as far as the layout of the project, like bread, where we talk about the history, we talk about ingredients, we talk about equipment and volume that's exclusively to recipes. Where bread had two volumes of recipes and especially for flour. There's much more all about flour in general in the bread book. But if you wanted to know more about the types of flours
And you really kind of dissect the whole thing in that sort of modernist way, right? That's like, we're going to take this back right to as first principles as possible, but also respecting the history, which is like that whole first volume in a way is kind of like the history and evolution of pizza.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that we really like, and that we also find is, a lot of nuances or inaccuracies is on historical documentation. I mean, sadly, that is where I think that the history of food really is neglected, unless it's food for the elite or rich.
Right.
In the early timeframes, you know, pre, let's say 1500s, 1600s, mm-hmm. You have mostly documentation from chefs that were serving royal families. But you don't really have documentation on things that were considered not necessarily for the elite, like bread, which was a little more well-documented because of the French and the German, because they were, there were schools very early on, or like the worships of bakers in London, that was very early 1800s, Worshipful Society of Bakers is their full name, I should say.
Right.
I went to visit them in London. It was really fascinating.
Oh, cool.
But for pizza, that did not exist. Pizza was really interesting because, you know, Italy itself didn't really exist until the 1500s.
True.
And so it was, you know, two Sicilies. And so it was a very early, a very late coming, organized country. And it was also continuously battered by a variety of people up until that point.
Right.
So documentation was destroyed. It also had the problem of having the capital go from Naples at the time of Sicily to, or the two Sicilies, I should say, and then moved to Rome. And so there was obviously a lot of Italian conflict going from what we would call a southern city of Italy to a northern city of Italy to Rome. And so that also provided a lot of turmoil for documentation. And so it's not encapsulated in beautiful fine art, which we would see right. in museums like we see for bread. Mm-hmm. And that was another early way for us to see what did bread really look like in the pre-1800s. It wasn't really something that would have gone back to earlier times where you would have lithographs or other documents. I mean, the only documentation we really have about food in Italy is Pompeii, right. and that's bread. Putting, you know, oil and maybe little fishes on their bread, probably not cheese or tomato, since neither of those things had come to Italy yet, that we know of. So it's just a really interesting history of pizzerias that probably existed early on, but they mm-hmm. may not have been called pizzerias. Or they might not have existed in a term or a way that we see them right now. They could have been street vendors selling something like pizza, which is probably what happened. But yeah, it was really fascinating. I mean, I actually have some, like, because I'm a book nerd, I brought a couple of my favorite books.
Oh yeah.
To talk about, just especially about the history side.
Sure.
So if you haven't noticed, I'm really passionate about the historical aspects. I worked really hard on the history with bread, and then also worked really hard on the history of pizza with a variety of editors as well as researchers. And one of the books that we found, and it's interesting to me that it's the history of food in general, is there's only a few really, like, I would call credited academic books out there. It's not really a class. It's not really studied. It's just now kind of coming to be, which is fantastic. But there was this book that was by the Slow Food Group, which love the Slow Food Group. They published this book on the Neapolitan pizza, Una Storia Napoletana. Okay. And it's by this gentleman named Dr. Antonio Mattozzi, who we actually ended up, he's a contributor into the project.
Oh, cool.
His daughter also is. I spent a lot of time with them when I was in Naples, talking to them about their documentation and research that they did. And then we also had, because, so not very many people know about this book, which I also find ridiculously fascinating when people are very interested in Neapolitan pizza. It is in Italian, but this wonderful person in Boston called, his name is Zachary Nowak. He translated the book into English. As you can see, I love this book so much. You can see all my caps, which is like a pure researcher nerd thing. Love the tabs. So Zachary wrote, basically translated this book, and it's now called Inventing the Pizzeria, the History of the Making of Pizza Making in Naples. And it's so awesome to have someone that was a researcher take the Italian version and then translate it into English. And
sure.
It's done by a small publisher. It's done by Bloomsbury, I think, out of the UK. That was one of the key things. Like, when we started looking at bread and found pizza had all these really interesting stories that we wanted to tell, it made it even more of a reason for us to just do a book on pizza. And then when we started researching even more, it led to a variety of other things. So the Princess Margherita story and the Margherita pizza is false. And there's a lot of documentation on it. It's basically just a marketing ploy for people to go to the specific pizza pizzeria in Naples, which I've been. But it's fascinating because it's also at a time where, especially now that we're in a pandemic, I think it's even more easy for people to understand that when this time that it says, I don't know how much you know about the Princess Margherita story and the Margherita pizza, but it comes up in the media all the time.
Right.
But, you know, it says that this wonderful princess, there was a gentleman that came to the castle, presented her with this pizza. It was the colors of the Italian flag.
Right.
And she ate it and she was like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever had. That's the Cliff Notes version of the story. But when this happened, it was a time when there was cholera in the streets of Naples.
Okay.
So the likelihood of someone on the street coming into your house and bringing you food, Now think about right now what we're going through.
Yeah.
We're in a pandemic. How many people are you allowing into your house right now?
Yeah.
Probably not many. And you're not royalty.
Right.
It's these little things that you kind of think like, sure, it's a beautiful story. You would hope it was true that someone from the streets came to this royal family and presented them with this food. And they were so blown away that they named it, you know, after her. But like, really, do you really think that would happen?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying.
And so, you know, it's kind of fascinating to see how this story has been retold and retold and retold and retold millions of times. But the one great thing is that there's documentation showing that there were all of these pizzerias existing way before the story actually unraveled.
Right. Yeah.
And that most likely there was pizza being served this way for a very long time.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just, it's fascinating. You know, it's like one of those things where you find out more and then you find out more and then you find out more, you know, just like our internet is. But yeah, that's like just one little we found in history that was great to see that people were already researching and discovering. I mean, it equates to the Lombardi story in New York, which is also wrong.
Okay.
People say it's the first pizzeria in America or in New York, depending on the story. But we were able to find pizzerias in San Diego before Lombardi is open.
Right.
And would you guess that San Diego had pizza before New York?
Yeah.
Probably not. So if San Diego had pizza before New York, then most likely a lot of places had pizza before Lombardi.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah. And so it's sort of every Netflix special that's ever been done about pizza is probably starting from a different, an incorrect starting point, but there you go, right? It's like, yeah.
No, you know, I mean, it's eye-opening, but it also takes a lot of work. I mean, our pizza book took 4 years to put together. Our bread book took 5 years to put together. And, you know, some stories go unsolved, right. You know, but when we look at the research and we bring people on to do even more deep dives into certain things, it's some things we find right away. Some things we're still trying to tackle and interested to find or get to the bottom of. So if anyone ever has documentation, you know, we're more than happy to look at it. But that I think is the hardest thing, is like to find true evidence, even in things that are within our own history, you know, with our own time. Sometimes it's really difficult to find.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and that sort of repeats itself or is also where you take it, I guess, on the technical side of things with like the, whether it's the ingredients or the process or that kind of thing, which is, you know, like volume two. And I love the picture right at the very start of the, or near the start of the book that, you know, here's, or on your website too, here's the lab that we're in.
Yes.
You know, that you folks have built. And it's sort of like, well, it's all full of baking equipment, but then over here is where we make new equipment. If we need to, you know, we'll just fabricate our own
stuff. Machine shop. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like, oh my gosh, you guys, like, let's get in. If you're going to get into it, I think that's the thing. And I mean this with a lot of admiration, but it's like, there are folks that claim to, you know, be bread nerds or gardening nerds or book nerds or whatever, but you folks go right to the edge. It's like, if we're going to do this, we're going way out there.
But no, I mean, I take that as an enormous compliment. I mean,
yeah. Oh yeah.
We're really fortunate that, you know, Nathan Mirbold, who's our founder, who I work for, who's,
right,
you know, our visionary for our projects. He's one of our photographers. He's a co-author. He's continuously inspiring us and pushing us to find new things. We're also able to do the research in a way that is credible. You know, it's not each of our books, we're typically using, I've worked on bread and I've worked on pizza. On both of those books, I have over 200 contributors.
Yeah.
Working with us. And so, you know, I would never, ever say that this is like a small team of people working, mm-hmm. You know, it's a small team within the Modernist Cuisine Group, which we're about 20 people. But the extent expanse that we reach out to, from, you know, cereal scientists to agronomists to, you know, we were looking at botanists for tomatoes. We were looking at cheese purveyors and people that studied the kind of the breakdown of cheese and how fermentation works for cheese, different than bread. Yeah. You know, all of these people are fabulous people that we're very fortunate to work with and be able to talk to and spend time with and expand our knowledge to what they have studied maybe for, you know, decades.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's sort of like and that's the thing. And I flipped right to the end of the last volume there where it's like, you know, here's the team. Mm-hmm. And you know, like I knew it was going to be big, but I looked and said, well, okay, well, here's like the six main people on the cooking side of things. Right. Mm-hmm. And then here's the six people working on photography, you know, and then, you know, you and five other folks on the whole editorial, and how in the heck are we going to do the research and corral it all together and make something out of it, you know? And then you flip to the next page and it's just like name after name after name of person that contributed on it. And it's just, it's very impressive. I felt the same way with the bread books when they came out, was that it's like, okay, as best as you can at this moment in time, this is the state of the art right now, you know, and it might evolve, or we're going to learn new things. But for right now, it's here's where we're at, folks, you know, and really get the same sense with pizza now too.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting perspective because, you know, we pride ourselves on learning more about innovation and people that are innovators. And, you know, in order to look at innovation, you do have to look at historical.
Yeah.
And kind of frame that into what is new, what isn't new. I mean, like, you know, when we looked at bread, ciabatta was from the 80s, which we found really insane that, like, people, you know, we were not, you know, we were so surprised that, like, ciabatta was invented in the 80s by a guy that was like a race car driver that started a bread company. So, you know, you would have never thought that, just like, you know, there's surprises in pizza too, where, you know, you think, you know, there's knowledge that you think, you know, but then when you actually go into it, you find that, oh yeah, this isn't right. Or, you know, it might've been a piece of the truth, you know?
Yeah. I'm really curious about this. I hope it's okay to ask, but like, I know you did a lot of, you've done a lot of publishing work in other areas before you came to the modernist team, right?
Yeah.
And I'm really curious how this is different for you, like, or is this just because I look at it, it's like, you know, it's a 5-year commitment for the first, there's 4 years for the second book. It's like you're traveling all over the world. You're coordinating so many moving pieces to get this together. How is that kind of your life before, or has this been sort of a big change for you?
So it's an interesting question. And so I've been in publishing for about 25 years.
Okay.
So I've been in books for quite a while. Love books.
Yeah.
Fascinated about bookmaking and also topics and how to take a topic from, you know, what your concept is to an actual finished book.
Right.
But I started in a very basic way of publishing, which was children's books.
Okay.
So educating younger kids predominantly with pop culture.
Okay.
So I was in licensing, in sales, for the very beginning of my time in publishing. Okay. And then while I was in New York, I switched gears and started to work on publishing both for adult and children's books at Simon & Schuster in an area that was called proprietary publishing, which is basically custom publishing for retailers. And so that also ran the gamut of a variety of licenses. But one of the biggest projects that I worked on before I left Simon & Schuster was working with Barnes & Noble. I worked with Barnes & Noble to create an omnibus of Hemingway stories.
Okay.
So in the, they had those beautiful leather bound editions, and they started doing some different licenses. And so I was able to work with the Hemingway estate to create this bound book, which was very huge, enormous opportunity to do. I mean, it's Ernest Hemingway.
Sure.
Everyone knows who Ernest Hemingway is, hopefully.
Yeah.
And so, so I started working on these, like, very, you know, working through the legal side, working with the contracts, and working with retailers. And so that was kind of an exciting opportunity for me. And there was an opportunity to move to Seattle to work with a company that was basically starting to do proprietary publishing for Amazon. Okay. And it was also all around pop culture. And so I wanted to come back to the West Coast. I'm from the West Coast. And so I thought this was a great opportunity for me to move back and, you know, see if it's what I want to continue to do. And so I started working on books exclusively for Amazon. They had what was called Amazon Publishing at that time. Mm-hmm. And so we started working on books around Star Wars was the big one.
Okay.
Biggest. And so we worked with LucasArts at that time. It was before Disney bought them, and spent a lot of time with the team for Lucas and George Lucas himself on creating books that were in their, theoretically in the world of Star Wars. So, now I told you I was a book nerd. Now you're finding even more nerdiness. I'm a bread nerd. I'm a pizza nerd. I'm just a nerd. 100% since I was a kid. And so we started bringing these books together, that were in within the world. So one of them was Book of Sith.
Okay.
And, it came out, it had a triangle shaped base with a motor that the book came out of this casing. It was $100. It had you know, it was like made the sound of Darth Maul or Darth Vader.
Right.
Had this beautiful book inside. It was just a really like amazing package.
Yep.
And it did really well at Amazon. So we started making these other books in other worlds for not only Star Wars, but then we moved into Star Trek and then Transformers, and the list goes on. So while I was there, we actually met with Modernist Cuisine. So before I moved to New York, when I was at Simon & Schuster, I worked on the sales end of Williams-Sonoma.
Okay.
So at that time, they had those beautiful cookbooks that came out, single subjects.
Yes. Like,
with beautiful photos on one side and a recipe on the other. And very different than what I do now, but very similar in a way that it's a brand. And it was very steaded in the way that Williams-Sonoma wanted everything to look. It was Williams-Sonoma's cookware that they were featuring in the stores, you know, you name it. Very stylized. So when I was in Seattle, well, when I moved here, we were talking to Modernist Cuisine to do more projects with them. And as I like to tell Nathan, I came in to tell them that they should make an even more deluxe edition of Modernist Cuisine. So because we were selling Star Wars books at, there was a book called Blueprints that was $1,000, but it had signatures and all these beautiful things. So I was talking to Nathan about how his team at the time, how we could do something bigger. And then about a year later, after working at Becker & Mayer, which was the company here, there was an opportunity that came up for a publisher at Modernist Cuisine. And so I reached out to the people that I met during this time, about a year before, and said, hey, you know, I don't remember meeting a publisher. So I'm curious, like, what is this role? And so I met with, at that time, was their editor-in-chief, who I met before, and talked to him. And he said, oh, you know, Nathan's really interested in building out a bigger publishing program that would be creating new books, because at that, by that time, it was Modernist Cuisine, Modernist Cuisine at Home, and Photography of Modernist Cuisine were out. And they were basically synonymous or derivatives of each other. But Nathan really wanted to create new projects, take them from scratch, and go full throttle.
Yeah.
So So I interviewed, and here I am almost 8 years later. And, you know, it's really interesting because while, like we were kidding before about how these projects are one project, but our chapters, for example, the history chapter, and I think Bread and in Pizza are over 100 pages.
Oh, yeah.
And so most people in the publishing world, that would be maybe a book, you know,
yes.
Maybe two chapters would be
totally.
And so I treat our projects as kind of mini books. So when we have 27 chapters, we have 27 books basically going.
Right.
The key thing is though, when you're working on a project, we're working on 27 little books that need to be tied together into one book.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for consistency, for voicing, to make sure that what we're saying in chapter one is still concurrent with chapter 27. It's a lot of juggling, you know, it's interesting, especially when we're getting towards the end of a project where we are working on three volumes, or for this book, three volumes, or Bread, we were working on five volumes at the same time.
Wow.
And, you know, it's juggling a lot of information at once. Yeah. But you know, it's challenging in a different way. You know, it definitely, every project we learn more and more about how we need to streamline processes or make little changes. One of the things with Pizza, which we really wanted to do for Bread, but we just didn't have enough time, was indexing. They had never done it before, but now right. We index each of the volumes for Pizza. So that was a huge positive change that we wanted to make. Also, just from an indexing standpoint, from when you have an index that indexes five volumes, thankfully I'm not the indexer, but yeah. it's a lot of work.
A lot of work. And as a reader, it's physically difficult to move all those volumes around if you're reading the index.
I mean, they're each 10 pounds. So it's, juggling literally 30 pounds at one time.
Totally. Yeah, thank you for that, because I'm a book nerd as well, and so I'm grateful for the Star Wars story, because it really helps me see sort of the thought process. Because the thing about the modernist Bread and Pizza books is, like, they're so clearly designed, and I can just imagine both the fun and the challenge of, okay, how are we, like, we're making them big on purpose. These are going to be like artifacts, the case matters, And so and I know we're going right back to the case, but, you know, the putting the beveled corners so the volumes are easier to pull out. Like when I saw that, I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. No, people thought about this, and I really appreciated it. So I was just like,
oh, thank you.
I get into that stuff big time.
That's so, me too. So yeah. I mean, it's small things like the beveled edges, the wedges that we put into for Bread. Those were a great little touch that Nathan had thought about. So it makes it easier for you to get your fingers in to pull the books out. You know, there's some things that we do that are, you know, we're really thinking through and trying to come up with how you can be a better reader from a lot of customer input, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Things that people have said, do this, could you do that? You know, Bread, for example, Bread has everything in metrics, volume, and baker's percentage.
Right.
Originally, Modernist Cuisine was only in volume, or I'm sorry, metrics, everything, so that however you read as a baker, you're able to complete our recipes. So pizza is the same. So it's in volume, metrics, and baker's percentage. So, you know, again, it makes it better for the reader to be able to accomplish the way that they feel comfortable measuring. Obviously, we prefer doing things in metrics and baker's percentage because it's a little more accurate. And especially right. Once you learn baker's percentage, it's so much easier to just continuously do because the conversion is great for batch size.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's so cool, because I have a couple of friends that are authors, and I always, and as I talk with them more, I learn more that, okay, it's not just somebody sitting down starting on page one, writing it out and away you go. And I understand like editors and designers and that. And then again, I was just sort of really blown away when I got a sense of the scope of what it takes to put together a project like yours is really cool.
Even from a photography standpoint, yeah. You know, our photo count for pizza was about 3,700 photos in the book, which seems like a big number, but we probably shot 200,000 photos for this mm-hmm. book.
Yeah. Well, and there's a little section in the preview thing that I saw that talked about even, you know, how Nathan and the photography crew got into how are we going to take these pictures so the colors are pure. And, you know,
exactly.
he's delving into the photography side, like everything, like every other component, you know, it's all very cool. Yeah.
No, it's true. I mean, the one thing that's new with pizza is that we did travel for pizza.
Yeah.
And so there's a travel section, which was a lot of fun, but it also added another layer of complexity because
sure.
we had to, you know, early on when we started traveling, we were kind of doing our normal way of traveling, which was just, you know, we pack gear set and we have a setup and, you know, we're trying to figure out what we're doing. But by the end, we had it down to a science where we had like, we knew we could use a 4-top table. We knew what size our, you know, we were going to do a top down side angle, all these views, and every pizza
right.
was captured the exact same way with the exact same lighting. So that when we did composites, which you'll see in the book, all of the pizzas are exactly the same from an angle. And so, you know, it's going back to that, you know, coming up with a one sheet of exactly what we're going to shoot every time and then applying that to every trip. So we went to over 250 pizzerias.
My goodness.
And so, you know, we tried to shoot them all the exact same one and some technique photos and outdoor photos and interior photos. But, you know, to be able to see, you know, a variety of margaritas exactly the same, all made in Italy, or a subset of all the margaritas made just in Campania or Naples, and look at them all together and really see the differences and the nuances and the similarities. You know, that's a great way for you to really learn what is a margarita.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Well, and I guess on the travel, did COVID bite you a lot, or were mm-hmm. you able to get, where were you in the process when travel became very hard?
So sadly, so we were fortunate in one way that most of our travel was done by the time that we hit lockdown in February here in Seattle. The only negative was that we had, because we were in Seattle, we were saving the West Coast for last because we thought, oh, well, we'll just go to the places that are the easiest for us to travel to at the end of the trip. So we were planning to go back to Portland to hit a few more pizzerias literally like 2 weeks after lockdown. We already had everything scheduled and all of our shooting ready to go. And that never happened. And then the same with the Bay Area. We were going to go to the Bay Area. I had done a lot of scouting trips beforehand. I probably have had 500 pizzerias, at least, because I would usually go and scout and talk to people and check out the pizza itself before we would do a team travel trip. So we do have some information about San Francisco, but it was very limited because that was postponed.
Right, right.
But it actually worked out well because, you know, we were wrapping up all of our travel. And so we just kind of had to nix those two things and continue on. So, I mean, we had our travel chapter is over 100 pages and we still had to eliminate some places that we went just because of space.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we would have probably had it. So it wasn't like we were looking for more. We didn't have enough to fill the page, I guess.
Exactly.
That's never the case.
I'm curious about Brazil and just because the one of the things I noticed is that gets pizza in Brazil gets a lot of attention, especially in some of the comparisons that I saw. And mm-hmm. I that was all brand new to me. I had no, I never considered Brazil as a place that I would want to go to if I'm scoping out pizza. And I was wondering if you could share a bit about that.
End of 1800s to early 1900s, they just as many people left to go to the States as they did to South America,
right?
To Argentina and Brazil. And so there is this traditional pizza making, and it still exists. That was really fascinating to see these traditional pizzerias, and some of them are still in place. There's also some places that have kind of a inspirational pizza on their menu to highlight the early pizzerias.
Okay.
That was really an interesting thing that I definitely think a lot of pizza people in general haven't been exposed to. Same with Tokyo. We went to Tokyo for pizza. That was towards the end of our travel time. And one of the best marinaras that I've had yet, I had in Tokyo.
Oh, cool.
And you wouldn't necessarily think that you would have an amazing Neapolitan pizza in Tokyo. But then again, I've had an amazing baguette in Tokyo too.
So yeah.
It kind of goes with the synergy of Asia, especially in Japan, where they perfect a craft beyond anyone else.
Yes.
And so the marinara and the margarita are very well appreciated and applied to cooking in Tokyo by some great pizzolos.
Yeah, that's something that I'm really noticing as well as I'm starting to meet more people, is the amount of good baking and, like, you know, bread and I didn't know pizza, but certainly bread that's happening in Asia, you know, was a surprise to me as well, but my own ignorance as opposed to that it's surprising, but you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not really as covered as much.
Yeah.
You know? So that's, I think, the biggest thing is that, you know, we continue to cover New York or Chicago deep dish, whether you love it or not. Just like pineapple on pizza, whether you love it or not, it should still be, you know, it's allowed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's things that we found that were really fascinating that a lot of people were like, oh, I didn't know about. So we do cover South America. We talk about the history as well of pizza in South America in the history section. So you can see the parallels of what's happening in the States when pizza leaves Italy with Italians.
Right.
And you know, the fruition of how things are now in Italy with pizza and the changes, the excitement of new pizza styles and new pizzolos and pizzolas, I should say.
Yeah.
That are taking pizza by storm.
Cool. I noticed as I was doing my research a little bit that you're very much involved in sort of the food world, the bread world, that kind of thing personally, you know, through the guild, through other organizations, I saw a note about the Washington cookbook, women's cookbook that you published and that kind of thing. And I was just curious to know a little bit about where your focus is or where your heart's taking you in the food world.
I am pretty active. I am very fortunate to be part of quite a few organizations and have been honored to be a participant, whether it's a speaker or presenter or moderator or you name it, helper sometimes too for a variety of the conferences for bread. I am also part of a couple women chef organizations, Parabere, which is an organization based out of France. That's a global group of women throughout the hospitality world. That is near and dear to me, that really is a great place for women to mentor other women in a variety of levels, from, you know, Michelin star chefs to publishers, writers, editors like myself, and everyone in between. So that definitely is a big one that I participate in. Obviously, with COVID, We haven't had our usual gathering, but we are going to have a virtual gathering actually at the end of this month. Women in Pizza is another one that I'm passionate about that I've been part of during the Pizza Project.
Cool.
It's a great organization that just connects a lot of women in the pizza industry. There are not a lot of women in the pizza industry. It's been predominantly a male-driven profession.
Gotcha.
But there's a lot of new women coming into the field and a lot of women that I highly respect that have kind of risen the challenge and taken the bar even higher to pizza making. Sarah Minnick, who's down in Portland, Oregon, beautiful pizza, just a really amazing woman who's like elevating the craft, using cool. a lot of local ingredients from flour to local farmer ingredients. Laura Meyer, who's down in San Francisco, she's been a competitor and won a variety of awards for her pizza globally. So yeah, so for me, it's really been a passion to focus on the community. To one, you know, there's a lot of really amazing women out there that a lot of people don't know about. And so for me and my team to really elevate them and add them to our roster
yeah.
of people that we talk about in our project, each of our projects, is important to me just to make sure that they do have their voice.
Totally.
And then I also, from a personal standpoint, I've been working with the Bakers Against Racism team that
yes.
started in June of last year and started a pop-up at my house last year.
Yeah.
Because we, obviously everything was locked down. So I invited a bunch of bakers and other makers, crafters in the community, and we did a monthly pop-up. We're still going strong. We've raised almost $10,000 now in a variety of nonprofits. Now we're focusing on Hurricane Ida victims in New Orleans. So last month we were working on women for women in Afghanistan.
Okay.
Earlier in the year, we were working on Stop the Hate for Asian issues.
Right.
So we did, a variety of different things. So that's been a big thing too for me to just continue to organize and bake. I made some Japanese milk bun rolls yesterday. And
yeah.
So I'm trying out some new recipes. It's just a good way for me to, stay within the community and create, something to give back to.
Oh, for sure. Awesome. Yeah, no, thank you. And thanks for sharing that. It's been so cool to talk to you, Stephanie, because I really, there's not an angle here that doesn't really grab me. It's the same reason that I do the podcast is to elevate bakers and raise the profile of bakers from all over the world and show the similarities, show the differences, that kind of thing. And so it was great to hear about your organizing work as well as the book publishing, book packaging, which I love, to pizza, which I love, to, the whole thing. So I just really appreciate getting to meet you and getting to talk to you for a bit, for sure.
Well, I can talk about bread and pizza forever. So, and sprinkle in a little book and pop culture knowledge too. So, it's definitely my pleasure of being part of the podcast. I really appreciate it. And, really look forward to having everyone get their hands on Modernist Pizza.
Yeah.
And not too much in the future. We're going on sale October 5th.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's right around the corner.
Yeah.
And you can always find out more on our website too at modernistcuisine.com. And if you want to find out more about me and whatever crazy things I'm eating or it's going to about pizza, my Instagram's S Swan, first initial, last name. And so, yeah, awesome. We'd love to hear from anybody about anything and keep baking.
Right on. Well, thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
Wow. So that was Stephanie. That was a lot of fun. Are you interested at all in history? Like, I'm thinking particularly of sort of that 18th century, 19th century voyages of discovery, you know, where explorers would go out around the world. Yeah. Yes. White guys and, you know, usually white European guys go out around the world collecting plants and animals and studying everything and then coming up with these massive compendiums of sort of, you know, here's the state of our knowledge on botany at this point, or here's the state of our knowledge on astronomy, you know, and that kind of a thing. And they would build these massive volumes of their research. And so much of these folks were independently wealthy and kind of, you know, that's how they funded these trips, right? It wasn't like the government funded it. I feel it the same with these modernist cuisine folks, right? Like they're on a 21st century voyage of discovery, whether it's about cuisine or it's about bread or now about pizza. I just love this idea of, well, oh yeah, of course we're going to go on a 5-year mission and we're going to travel the world and we're going to get to the bottom of this whole pizza thing and really, really dig into the history and the spread of it and the variations and all of that. It's an investment in many ways to create a book like this. It's an investment to read a book like this. It is big, but I think it's one well worth taking. I think the other thing that really grabbed me about this set of books and about talking to Stephanie was this idea of design. You know, this is an intentionally designed set of books, you know, and Modernist Bread was as well, right? It everything from the layout to the packaging to the conscious decision to make these horribly unwieldy 10-pound volumes, you know, like that kind of thing. It was all designed. It was done on purpose. And I love that. And I just keep thinking it's the same for your bakery, right? You get to design every aspect of it, you know, from the look, from the branding, from the way your products look, to how they're displayed, to how they're packaged, to how they're labeled. And all of it collectively tells a story, right? Tells a story to your customers about what it is that you're serving them. And, you know, you can take it super serious. You can take it super scientific like they do with the modernist books. You can be whimsical and fun. You can speak to comfort food like Sarah did last week with the bread lady and the way that she does her baking. And it's about comfort and family and family traditions and that kind of thing. You get to choose. And no matter what you choose, I just hope you really go for it. You know, really lean into that area, that angle that you've chosen, that facet of this baking world that you said, this is where I'm going to put my stake in the ground, and really go for it and design around that. So I don't know. That's what I think of when I see these modernist books. As interesting as the content is, and it's very interesting, I just look at that commitment to the ideal of we're going to get as much knowledge as we can out of this topic and the commitment to design that they put around it. So my 2 cents. Well, that's it for this week. 150 episodes of the Rise Up podcast. Thank you for listening. If you're new to the show, go to riseuppod.com. There are 149 more, just like this. There's even some bonus episodes in there that don't make the count. So, you know, there's more than 150 shows there to listen to if you choose to. Dig in, riseuppod.com. Drop me a line on the website or mark@riseuppod.com. The email's fixed. It now works. Send me a note. Would love to hear from you. Until next week, work hard, bake lots, stay safe, stay healthy, happy baking. Bye-bye.